that doesn't move you, I do not know what will. But Paul, when he walks into the city, is moved, and you and I should be as well. And so, the verse continues, verse 17. And so he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons, and in the marketplace, every day with those who happened to be there. Some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also conversed with him, and some said, "What does this babbler wish to say?" Paul had the exact same framework every single time he entered into a new city. He always went into the synagogue and he met people who were like-minded as him, and then he went off into the marketplace and he spoke to those who were outside of his own community. You see the way that he worked? That he went to his community and then he went out from there to go reach people. When you attend this service, when you go to your churches, the responsibility of sharing the gospel does not find itself in your youth pastor or in the pastor of your churches or in Evan here. It is not his job to save your friends. It is not his job to share the gospel with your friends. The responsibility of sharing the gospel with the people that you know and love is on you. That's a job. And we at churches cultivate this thing where it's, hey, we're going to make this big, awesome thing, and you come to us, and then we will share it. But Paul's message is, no, let me go to them. And we've reversed the whole thing. We've done this in many cases. Let me say it this way. The Lord's Supper has changed from celebration to a ceremony. Worship has changed from participation to observation. Witness has changed from relationship to salesmanship. Leadership has changed from servanthood to professionalism. Mission has changed from being missionaries to supporting missionaries. Body life has changed from edification to entertainment. And buildings have changed from functional to sacred. You and I are opposite of the results of our lives is operating in the opposites of how it's actually intended to go. And the people who are listening to Paul at this moment are quoted to be two kinds of individuals. One is an Epicurean and the second is a Stoic. An Epicurean is your modern day hipster, okay? Your Epicurean, there's an Epicurean bakery right in Kingsway if you want to go there on the mainland and you'll get your gluten-free just like, hey, here's a piece of grass. Or whatever, like you hang out and you like go there and you eat grass and you hang out and these are the individuals who, these are the people who live for the moment. Like they live right now. So whatever's good for me right now, that's what I'm doing. These are the people who love pleasure. Pleasure is ultimate. Oh man, I want choices. I want to live now. These are the individuals who Paul is interacting with. To eat, drink, and be merry for tomorrow you die is their motto. This is how they work. And those people live in your city. Those people go to your schools. Those people are in your workplaces. The second part is the uber-disciplined, very strong, ascetic individual. Those are the Stoics that believe that knowledge is incredibly important. And sure, they're open to a God, but they don't really know which one. Those people are also in your schools, also in your workplaces, also in the places of influence that you have. And Paul is speaking to both of those. And how do they respond to him? With one word, babbler. It's a babbler. It's a gutter bird. That's the language. It's a bird that goes to a gutter and picks up gross things and just kind of picks up little tiny objects. The modern equivalent to you and I is the individual who walks down the street like looking for half-smoked cigarettes so they can pick them up and smoke it for themselves. It's someone who picks up information for their own use whenever is needed for them, and they compile this weird jargon of philosophy, and this is what they look to Paul and say, that's what you are. You're talking nonsense. You're a babbler. And all of a sudden, what he begins to realize is when he shares the gospel, he is impacted in such a way where his ego is hurt. His ego is hurt. But let me ask you the question. In the sharing of the gospel and telling people about Jesus, what is much more important, your ego or their eternity? It has to be that way. It has to be in this. You will be embarrassed. You will be made fun of. You will be sitting there with, at times, low self-esteem after a meeting with someone. And let me just affirm to you people here in the room, it is worth it. It's worth it. For people who are far from him to know him, it is worth it. And he continues. Others said he seemed to be a preacher of foreign divinities. It's important. Because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. They took him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, may we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting. For you bring some strange things to our ears. We wish to know, therefore, what these things mean. Now all the Athenians and the foreigners who live there would spend their time stop it. Right? That's crazy. So Jesus is overwhelming for people. You have to deal with that. And then there is the resurrection. And what both of those things mean is that you and I are completely different individuals. I heard my pastor say a couple weeks ago, and it was so overwhelming for me to hear about this, but I'm the worst case scenario guy, right? So all of a sudden it rains or it snows, it's like, oh, this is accidents galore. Like when I get on an airplane and we hit turbulence, at any moment I go, this puppy's going down, right? That's me, right? And then I always make fun of the stewardess or the flight attendant who walks by and goes, put your seatbelt on. I go, oh, this is going down and the seatbelt's really going to do a lot, Trudy, right? Like, no. That's how I feel. I'm like, what is it? But this is crazy. This is what's crazy about Paul, Jesus, and the resurrection. If that's his message in that moment when I'm on that airplane, and say that thing does go down, what this means is it's not the prosperity gospel where I am safe from dying. No, 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 no. What it means if that airplane goes down, because of Jesus and the resurrection, it's not that I am safe from dying, it's that I am safe in my death. That's completely different. You know what that makes me? Untouchable. Death cannot have me anymore because of him. Jesus has won that battle. It's over. So all you could do is make fun of me, but I am unstoppable. Because the God that I believe in did something unbelievable. He won. And I know the end of the story. Imagine if you lived your life like that. Imagine how many things we worry about that in 6 months we won't even remember. Imagine you lived your life in such a way where you had the unstoppable fervor of God constantly with you. Imagine if God's presence was with you every day. It is. Unstoppable. Jesus and the resurrection, and these guys look at them, and they're confused. And they have to be. Because when you are living a life in the kingdom, everything changes. This is the way that Leslie Newbegin said it. Living in the kingdom of God, or live in the kingdom of God in such a way that it provokes questions for which the gospel is the answer. That's stunning. Haven't you ever noticed that when someone is so moved by the Spirit, so won over by the gospel, people begin to ask questions? I remember being in high school. I was just overwhelmed by Christ and his story. Luke 15 in particular was what ruined me as a kid. And I heard that story and my life was different. I then, at the high school parties that I used to drink at, whatever, I would go to those high school parties and become mom. It was crazy. I had a backpack that had bread and socks. And when I got to drive, I would drive people home. And there would be moments where, like, guys, like, have girls by the hand and leading them.
get it.
Like, this is intense right now. This is that point in the movie when you're watching it and the killer is in the house and they're hiding in the closet and all of a sudden it's like... They're all in the closet. There's that one girl in the closet who hears a noise and goes, I wonder if Mr. Fluffy is okay. My cat's really sad. I need to see if he's okay. And for some reason, she gets out of the closet and starts walking, and everyone in the theater knows what's going on. Oh, she's dead. Right? And as she walks out, all of a sudden, the music gets so loud and so loud, and all of a sudden, you're getting sweaty palms and you're nervous, and then all the music cuts out. There you go. Oh, now she's really dead. Right? That's what he just did. Luke, the writer of Acts, just did that. We are right now. As soon as Paul shows up to the Areopagus, the music is gone. This is tense. And you want to know why? Because the story of a man walking into Athens, proclaiming a message that is interpreted to be talking about foreign divinities and taken to the Areopagus, has already happened once. And Luke is portraying Paul as the new individual going through the same story. And the last time this happened, the man who went to the Areopagus died because of it. And as soon as I tell you who it is, you will know their name. The last individual who walked into Athens, proclaimed a message that was interpreted for foreign divinities, and was taken to the Areopagus was a man named Socrates. And Socrates was killed because of this event. And Luke is portraying Paul as the new Socrates as he walks into this place, walking into Athens, proclaiming foreign divinities, walking to the Areopagus, and about to be judged. This is at ultimate tension. And look at what happens. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also this, on the altar, this inscription, to the unknown God. What therefore you worship is unknown, this I proclaim to you. Now, this is crazy right now. I don't think you've ever been to Greece. If you've ever been to Greece, it's a cool spot. Me and my wife got married. We did our honeymoon in Greece. And so we actually went to the Areopagus. The Areopagus is Ares Hill, or in Roman, it's the Mars Hill, right? So Mars Hill is just a big, giant rock. And so me and my wife, you know, we go, and we're like, we just got married, so we're like, hey, we walk to the rock, and we're sitting down, and we're like, we're Christians, so we do cheesy things. We're like, let's read, like, Acts 17, and we're like, oh, gosh. So we're like reading it, and like, I'm that guy where I stepped on every piece of the rock just to be able to go, I stepped where Paul steps, like, actually, right? So we sit down, and her, like, head is on mine, and we're like, oh, gosh, Paul was here, right, you know? It's crazy. But when you're there, geography does something very interesting. When you turn around, what do you see? The most famous Greek temple in all of Greece is right there. I could grab a stone and hit that thing. Incredible arm. Anyone could do it, right? It is so close. So Paul gets thrown into the Areopagus in front of all of these philosophers and judges, and he is facing the most famous of Greek temples of the gods. And what does he say? Here it is. Verse 24. The God who made the world and everything in it, being the Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man. Are you kidding me? Man, how many opportunities have you been given the chance to share the gospel with someone and backed away and avoided it because of fear? Because of pressure? Because of insecurity? Paul, in the midst of giving his life for something, does not shy away but doubles down. Isn't that crazy? He's so untouchable. He walks into the lion's den and looks at the temple and says, listen, the God that I know, King Creator, who spoke all of existence with words, doesn't live there. He doesn't live there. He's bigger than that. wish I had that power. I wish I had that confidence. And you should. Because Paul is no different than you. Paul is a man just like you, moved by the Spirit and has been given it every single day. So what are you going to do with it? This is Paul's life. And not only that, he keeps going. Verse 26 or 25. Nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything, and he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way towards him. That people are longing after something, and even though they are blind, the image that he's giving is, you know, at times where you're in your house and all the lights are off, but you've memorized your house so much that maybe you might be dark, but you're kind of doing this, right? And you kind of know the couch is here and the table's there, and you're like, oh my goodness, right? You kind of are feeling your way towards without any other sense, but you are longing to get to where you desire. That's what people are feeling about the Lord. That's what he's saying. That they're going to get there. They're feeling their way towards him. But God is the one who is known. And then he continues and says this, and he quotes two Greek poets. Yet he is actually not far from each one of us, for in him we live and move and have our being. As even some of your own poets have said, for we are indeed his offspring. Paul was not afraid to talk about the things that the world is talking about, nor is he afraid to include information and wisdom from those who are outside of the church. He understands that truth is truth, and wisdom is wisdom, and knowledge is knowledge, regardless of where it is coming from. Now, that's weird for us at times. That's strange for us. But when you begin to put this into context, you understand what he's saying. There's one man named George MacDonald. He was the role model for J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis. And he wrote amazing things. And this quote is probably one of my favorite things that he ever wrote. This is what it says. One difference between God's work and man's is that while God's work cannot mean more than he meant, man's must mean more than he meant. For in everything that God has made, there's layer upon layer of ascending significance. Also, he expresses the same thought in higher and higher kinds of thought. It is God's things, his embodied thoughts, which alone a man has to use, modified and adapted to his own purposes for the expression of his thoughts. Therefore, he cannot help his words and figures falling into such combinations in the mind of another as he himself not foreseen. So many are the thoughts allied to every other thought. So many are the relations involved in every figure. So many the facts hinted in every symbol. A man may well himself discover truth in what he wrote, for he was dealing all the time with things that came from thoughts beyond his own. He's not afraid. He knows that even if these individuals, their motivations are coming from a completely different place, they are saying something that is meaningful for progressing the gospel, and so he moves it. It's powerful. And I'll end off with this, in this last section of what Paul begins to do. Verse 29. Being then God's offspring, we ought not to think that a divine being is like God, a gold or silver or stone, an image formed by art and imagination of man. In times of ignorance, God overlooked, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent, because he has fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed. And of this he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. Now, when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked, but others said, we will hear you again about this. So Paul went out from their midst, but some men joined him and believed, among whom also were Dionysius the Areopagite and a woman named Damaris and others with him. Paul's bold proclamation, Paul's just zeal for the Lord, led him to a place that in the midst of all of the fear, insecurity, pain, struggle, people came to know him. People came to know Christ. People came to know Christ. It was worth it. Let me tell you, individuals in the room, that if you get made fun of, if you get mocked, if you get pressured, if you feel insecure, leading someone to Jesus is worth it. It's worth it. And have faith and hope, because I look at you all in the room and I say, let me tell you, you do not have to be qualified in order to be used. You can do it. And I don't think this is going to go well for